TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Vandana Shiva on the 250 million people strong protest by Indian farmers. The 2020-21 Indian farmers protest is an ongoing campaign against three farm laws. They were passed by the Parliament of India in September 2020. National and international media have been heavily censoring what is now known as the largest peaceful and enduring protest in the history of social movements. It all began on November 26, 2020 in India. 250 million people stood together in a united worker-farmer strike. Farmers' unions and their representatives demanded that the laws be repealed and will not accept anything short of it. The laws, often called the farm bills, have been described as anti-farmer laws. They would leave farmers at the mercy of corporations with monopoly control over the purchase, pricing, and distribution of farm products. Stock market advisors are asking, who benefits from the farm bills? Specifically, it seems, the mega corporations owned by Mukesh Ambani and Gautam Adani. They also happen to have funded the $5 billion political campaign which won BJP Narendra Modi the Prime Minister's office. Also, during the COVID lockdowns, Facebook Mark Zuckerberg invested $5.7 billion and Google Alphabet Inc. invested $4.5 billion for an equity stake in Ambani's mega corporation, Jio. This Facebook, Google, and Ambani alliance is set to capture India's internet boom and forced transition to a digital economy. In this business plan, WhatsApp is slated to become the purchase point of food distribution in India, eliminating small businesses, local vendors, neighborhood corner shops, and farmers' markets. In mid-January 2021, the Indian physicist and ecologist Vandana Shiva wrote an article for the Times of India. She said, "Neither farming nor food can be a mere commodity. The food web is the web of life. How we grow, transport, and process our food is the single biggest determinant of the health of our planet and our own individual health. Today, one-third of all greenhouse gas emissions come from an industrialized food system. Over three-fourths of the destruction of the Earth's soil and water is also due to this system. Further, 1 million diverse species on Earth face an extinction crisis because of this unsustainable farming system. As my research has shown, such industrial food chains spread over vast distances are ecologically destructive. But through local, biodiverse, and organic farming systems, we can reverse these impacts. Conscious eating can heal both our planet and our own health." That was Vandana Shiva writing on the impact of an industrialized food system forced upon Indian farmers by the Farm Bill. That spawned the largest protests in the history of social movements. At the beginning of February 2021, Vandana Shiva sat down for an interview on India's farmers' protests and the colonial history of farmer rebellions with Aditi Meyer. Vandana Shiva earned her PhD in quantum theory at the University of Western Ontario. She then became one of the passionate defenders of soil, seed and farming, and is based in Dehradun, India. Vandana Shiva explains why India's farmers are no strangers to the corporate hijacking of the fruit of their labor, their land, and farming culture. Aditi Meyer is a labor rights activist and frequent speaker on topics of social and environmental justice. Here's Vandana Shiva.
Let me take you back to the Green Revolution. Here's the Green Revolution that says Punjab will grow grain for everyone else and it will only be rice and wheat. And rice is not a Punjab crop, but they were forced to grow rice. And now it should supply the whole country. 40% of the supply of food of India today, especially the public distribution system, is now grown by the farmers. Now this grain had to be brought somewhere so the government could pick it up and supply it around the country. These were called the mandis. So the current act is in effect trying to hand over the trade to the giant corporations. The difference between 1991, when the big corporations were the Cargills for grain and the Monsantos, the difference is today we have our own giants who all have partnership with global giants. They don't work alone. I mean, suddenly out of the blue, a Reliance cannot become a digital company without the help of Microsoft and Gates. They cannot become a grain company, or Adani can't become a grain company overnight. So they're becoming the front, just like when Monsanto entered, they entered behind Mahiko. They always find an Indian partner to hide behind. And the current protests are against the third law. So one is dismantling of the Essential Commodities Act, which means totally deregulated prices and a recipe for famine. This doesn't affect the farmer as much as the country and the poor. The second is dismantling the regional system where states decided, and there were cooperatives of farmers and small traders, and there was a stock limit that goes and the big giants can go by. But the third is the contract law. Now, all these three they've been trying to put in place since 1991, but I always smile at the COVID, you know, the little virus. I say so many racketeers hid behind you, COVID, to do things they could not do when democracy was vibrant. But the beauty of the protest today is, in spite of the lockdown, millions of farmers have shown how a vibrant democracy can look. The farmers are totally rightfully rejecting these laws, and they keep saying their farmers are afraid. Farmers are afraid. No, farmers have experienced since 1991 the corporate hijack of their share of what the consumer pays, whether it's in clothing or it's in food. And they also know that if this down, and the prices have gone like this, you know, with globalization, the price the farmer gets is going like this, the price the consumer pays goes up. And the Arab Spring was actually a bread riot because the food prices had jumped up. Now farmers know if this system of deregulated commerce is pushed and no regulation is there, these prices are going to collapse and they won't be able to survive. And they're fighting for survival. And I'm totally behind them because this, I say, is a fight for the soul of India. It is a fight for the civilization and its values that has consciously stayed agrarian in spite of repeated attempts to dismantle our agrarian soul and leave us both desertified in terms of the soil and desertified in terms of our soul. So we are in a very, very critical juncture. And I've seen too many tricks played over these decades of work I've been doing. And I just hope all the strength stays with the farmers who have shown their strength so long. And they continue to say, it's either yes to our demand of repeal the laws or a no, in which case we will not go home till you repeal the laws. And what we are seeing on the streets of Delhi or all over the country today with the Bharat Bandh is a continuation of this exploitation. And to me, this is genocide. I've said it, I've been trolled by the Monsantos of the world. But when you deliberately harm a community, and farmers are a community, and you cause harm to the extent that 400,000 of them have to commit suicide, this is genocide and it has to stop. And I hope your networks will play their role to create another economy through a new solidarity. The agriculture minister invited me to draft the farmers' rights law. We are the only country in the world that has a law, the Plant Variety Protection and Farmers' Rights Act. And we put a clause, Article 39, that farmers are breeders, therefore, and their right to save, exchange, improve, sell seed can never be taken away. Pepsi sued 4 potato farmers of Gujarat last year for 40 million rupees. I sent this book to the lawyers and the judges, the book which has these laws, and Pepsi had to withdraw that case.
So fast forward to the 1960s and 1970s, a critical juncture in India's agriculture sector was the Green Revolution. And Dr. Shiva, for those that are not familiar, can you give a brief overview of what the Green Revolution was, for its benign name, and what its impacts were that were not so green?
So, you know, there was no green politics at that time. The word green did not mean ecology. Green was just a different color from red. And the Americans were very scared of red. So they just wanted a different name. The Green Revolution was not green. It was not revolutionary. It was basically an attempt being made ever since the wars ended to take war chemicals, the chemical fertilizers, were basically made in the same labs and same factories in which the explosives were made, the same IG Farben, made nitrogen fertilizers and made explosives, and the same process. All of the pesticides are derivatives of Xylon B and poison gases that were made again for Hitler's concentration camps and for the wars. So after the wars were ended, instead of just folding up and saying we'll shut these factories, they had got so addicted to making huge money. And Rachel Carson has written about it in her book, Silent Spring. Albert Howard has written about it in his book, An Agricultural Testament, that those who had got addicted to making money out of selling chemicals continued to sell them now as agrichemicals. So the big issue was they wanted to sell fertilizers and chemicals. The problem was, you know, Satyagraha is Gandhi's word for non-cooperation based on truth. And when chemicals were applied to our native varieties of seeds, which were tall, because they were dual purpose, the straw gave food for the animals and the grain gave food for us. So we created dual purpose animals, milk from the cows and animal energy from the bullocks, and dual purpose crops to feed the animals, including human animals. But when you apply chemicals to these tall crops, they lodge if there's wind or too much rain. And this problem of lodging was the big problem. So they kept trying Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, and then Norman Borlaug, who worked for DuPont Defense Lab, was put on the job of changing the plant to adapt to the chemicals rather than adapt the farming techniques to the native seeds. And that's why he created the dwarf varieties. And these dwarf varieties were misleadingly called high yielding varieties. How can less be more? You know? And when I did my Green Revolution book, my eyes would tell me, here's a lie, but my science would tell me, bigger lie. These were not high yielding variety. They were high chemical demanding varieties, high response varieties, but they needed 10 times more water to grow the same amount of food. And that's the root of the water crisis of Punjab, for which the farmers are being blamed. But it was imposed on them. There were conditionalities put. If you couldn't show you had taken chemicals, you couldn't take a loan to send your daughter to college. Credit conditionalities on the farmer, and on India, credit conditionalities from the World Bank. All of this also meant these short varieties came with mechanization, and just the top of the grain was picked up by the harvester and the stubble was left, and they told the farmer, burn the stubble. And now they told the farmer, use your water, use the chemicals. They told the farmer, burn the stubble. And now they want to fine farmers 20 million rupees each for doing what they were told to do. So one of the demands of the farmers right now is this should not be criminalized. So the Green Revolution, what did it end up doing? And it was prescribed by the World Bank. It was conditionality. 65, we had a drought. The prices of wheat went up slightly. And those days we used to, under rupee payment, import a little extra rye wheat from US. It was called the PL Poiti. And Lal Bahadur Shastri asked for a little more wheat to stabilize prices. No one was dying of hunger and famine. There was no famine in India in 65. I was in school and I remember. Prices rose up. Sugar was a problem. And the US said, sorry, we won't send you wheat unless you change your agriculture and use chemicals. And Shastri said, I will not experiment with such a large agrarian population. We can do it on a small scale. And if it works, we'll adopt it. And then Lal Bahadur Shastri died in Tashkent. The pressure continued. And the Green Revolution was imposed. By 91, we had structural adjustment because the debt of the Green Revolution for dams, for irrigation, for chemicals, for the whole system. Now, actually, the system that was created was only Punjab. If you think of it, Aditi, so during British time, the Punjab farmers refused to become serfs and stayed owner cultivators. By the time Green Revolution came, they said, we got to build on the best because this wasn't a destroyed agriculture. And then they started to destroy it. And as a result of that, by 1984, the farmers of Punjab resisting. 84 was a peasant movement. The narrative was changed, but it was a farmers' movement. And the farmers were saying, and I have it written here, the Shiromani, you know, there was a declaration, I think, the Gurmat Khasla said, if the hard-earned income of the people or the natural resources of any nation or region are forcibly plundered, the goods produced by them are paid at arbitrarily determined prices, while the goods bought by them are sold at high prices. And in order to carry this process of economic exploitation to its logical conclusion, the human rights of people or of a nation are crushed, then these are indices of slavery of that nation, region, or people. Today, the six are shackled by chains of slavery. This type of slavery is thrust upon the states and 80% of India's population of poor people and minority. And we mustn't forget, my mother herself became a refugee. She, you know, she had studied in Lahore and was working in Lahore, and then the partition happened. The partition left only Sikh farmers. Earlier, there used to be a mixture because of the Sikhs moved this side and the Muslims moved that side. So the farmers of Punjab are Sikhs. And they communalized the farmers' protest. And every narrative, if you look at it, 84 story is never told in terms of the farmers. 4th of June, the farmers of Punjab are going to blockade the supply of grain to Delhi. They had blockaded the governor's house. They were going to blockade the trains. So the Green Revolution brought 84. Then the 91 is a buildup of the new reforms, and maybe we can come back to that on another round. I can quickly tell you that 30% of the debt of 91, the 90 billion debt, was caused by the Green Revolution. And that then started to push new reforms, they call it, yeah, which is basically create a crisis, use it as an opportunity to expand your control and your market. So in 2000, I did a public hearing on farmer suicides. This was in Bangalore. This is a Sikh farmer who had come, whose brother has committed suicide because of debt. And that's not all. In 2006, this is still in my heart. It's still, I still carry this pain. You know, usually in Punjab, everyone's with a colorful turban. All the women are in colorful chunnis. This is all white. 2,000 widows in a gurdwara in Bathinda, giving evidence to us. We were on a jury, a public jury of a public trial. 2,000 widows, and all of them said, and then he took the spray, as a spray kehte hain, you know, in Punjabi, a spray, yeah, the poison spray. They took the spray that got them into debt for the BT cotton. They were all BT cotton farmers. Vidarbha suicides, Bathinda suicides, all connected through the poison cartel. And what we are seeing on the streets of Delhi or all over the country today with the Bharat Bandh is a continuation of this exploitation. And to me, this is genocide. I've said it, I've been trolled by the Monsantos of the world. But when you deliberately harm a community, and farmers are a community, and you cause harm to the extent that 400,000 of them have to commit suicide, this is genocide and it has to stop. And I hope your networks will play their role to create another economy through a new solidarity.
All of you touched on such important touch points in history, as well as what's happening currently within the landscape of India, from the Green Revolution to the modern farmer bills. But I want to take a step back and rewind a bit. And I want to talk about the beginnings of this shift where we had colonization. And in 1664, the East India Company was created. And one of the major goals was to subdue India's textile economy. And so there was a plan, a systemic plan created to subdue the Indian farmer and make the switch from subsistence farming to cotton crop. And this was a very pivotal point. Not only would this eventually subject farmers to a cycle of interest-laden debt, it would also diminish the food supply. India was to constantly supply the British mills with cotton, being only the exporter of raw material, only to be sold that cotton back at a premium, which left our own spinners and weavers unable to afford that cotton. Britain became this workshop of the world, and especially during the 19th century, the US and British cotton relationship, which was predicated on the use of slave labor in America, also further diminished India's textile economy. So with that framing in mind, Dr. Shiva, you have said that the rupture of oneness with the earth was a very deep construct and impact of colonialism. So we know this to be true when it comes to the modes of agriculture and how our relationship with land and labor is so predicated on output, output, output. So I'd love to know, how do you think colonialism has affected our modern day understanding of both land and labor?
Yeah, the East India Company, as the name tells you, was created to conquer India, because India at that time was 25% of the world economy. We were the world economy, and we were the traders of the world for spices and textiles. And given that your platform is a fashion platform, you know, literally till globalization. For me, the poorest woman in the poorest village was walking fashion, you know, because we'd managed after independence to bring textiles back. How did colonialism change land and labor? We never believed in property in land. It's just sabhi bhumi gopal ki dharti ma. Even now at the farmers' protest, they keep talking about the mother as, or the soil as their mother. And what they're fighting for is their bond with her. So the British, colonialism was a mega, mega, mega land grab. Not just in India, you know, the peasant lands were taken and became colonial lands. And then the British appointed zamindars. And the brilliant, and this is something you should look at, we have two volumes of the ecological history of food and farming, because in the Northwest provinces, as it was called, the farmers' protest started immediately with this extraction of lagan, the rent. And I have links to Sir Chotu Ram, who was the governor at that time of the Northwestern provinces. But the farmers protesting today were farmers who fought against the British zamindari and stayed owner cultivators. They were never working for landlords, or were never landlords hiring other labor. But the East India was turned to zamindari, was pushed to famines. So the land relationship was not totally alienated, and the Land Alienation Act of Northwestern provinces kept the Punjab farmer a proud, independent farmer, which is why they've risen again and again and again. So they made land their property and collected rents called lagan. $45 trillion was transferred by the British. Where did the lagan come from? From the farmers. What was this 45 trillion of wealth transferred to England? The creativity, productivity of the land, and the creativity and productivity of the farmer. 45 trillion of this wealth was transferred by the colonial system. And the peasants who created that wealth were pushed to famine. 60 million famine deaths during the British period. Of course, they then created the fabric of theorizing what science is Bacon, what property is Locke, what politics is Hobbes. I mean, I want to do a bonfire of these big white men's lies, because they brainwashed so many generations of people. And Adam Smith writes this book on the wealth of nations, which is really about the theft from nations. And he talks about it being in our DNA to be greedy and take away from others. No, it's in our DNA to protect the earth, share. Look at the langars on the streets where the farmers are protesting. the giving of food. This is not about grabbing, it's about giving. So how was land changed? It was turned into property, but of the colonizer. And the original non-prop, they were custodians. They were left destitute. But land was also turned into an inert dead matter. And all the theorizing of the Bacons of that time was the earth is dead matter. So not only did it take life, take away resources of the presence, it took away life from the land. And my life's work for the last so many decades, 50 years now, has been to show how capitalist patriarchy totally redefined our relationships with the earth and our perception of ourselves. Our bodies were also turned into inert raw material. And our only work was as slaves. But if you think, and the narrative that was built, it was the mills of Lancashire and Manchester that created the wealth of England. No, they were colonizing 200 years before those mills came. And their empire was an empire of cotton, for which they grabbed all of the land of the indigenous people of the Americas, turned it into cotton plantations. But because it was so much, they then had to capture Africans and slaves. And do tell the Black Lives Matter movement that it is time to create a global unity against colonialism. It is not just a problem of one group of people on one piece of land. It's a global problem. And we are connected through cotton being turned from the thread of prosperity to a thread of slavery. In terms of labor, this, I think, is the big deconstruction that has to be done, the decolonization of work. The earth was reduced to land as an inert input, and we were reduced to labor as a commodity to be sold. I'm not going to go into depth because so much has been written about alienation of labor, about extraction of surplus value, the entire edifice of inequality, exploitation, extraction, both from the earth and from people. And sadly, because we've inherited those definitions as if they are Bibles written by Christ himself or Moses, Ten Commandments, people still think within those categories. So people are taking it as inevitable. Even though Gandhi totally challenged the idea of industrialization with the spinning wheel, people are taking it as inevitable that artificial intelligence and robotics are going to destroy all work and 99% humanity will be useless. Now is the time for the spinning wheel in every hand, the seed in every hand. Decolonization means the colonizer's agenda must be challenged with another imagination.
That was the Indian physicist, now seed and soil protector, Vandana Shiva. She has authored over 20 books, including The Violence of the Green Revolution, Monocultures of the Mind, Soil Not Oil, and Oneness versus the 1%. Thanks to Aditi Meyer for the interview and for posting on YouTube. Vandana Shiva spoke at the beginning of February 2021 on the ongoing Indian farmers' protest against three farm bills which were passed by the Parliament of India. This program was produced on February 15, 2021. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.